You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
So, hey, we've been making this podcast for over 2.5 years.
What?
Yep, thanks to listeners like you. And from the gate, people have asked us for merchandise or additional content or even some hang time with me and Scott.
That's weird.
It is. But we think we have a solution for you.
Yep, we are excited to announce that we have a new Patreon page.
Yeah, and you know how people are patrons of the arts? Well, in this case, we're the arts.
Hmm. And by becoming a Patreon, you'll get bonus content, access to outtakes that the general public will never see, extremely cool merch, and depending on what tier you get on, a monthly hang time with Laura and I.
Yep, and it all starts at just $5 a month.
That's nothing.
Right? Not per day, not per week. It's only $5 per month.
And you're guaranteed merchandise.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So click the link in the show notes to read about the different tiers and see what great stuff you can get. Become a podcast patron. Join our Patreon today at www.patreon.com/theonlyoneintheroom.
Several times a week, Laura will turn to me after we get into bed and say those six little words I've been waiting to hear all day. Can I read something to you? Once I've said yes, she reaches for an item from her very cluttered nightstand and proceeds to bring that book, blog post, poem, essay, or article to life with her voice. I hope you enjoy listening to her read as much as I do. Here's this week's selection from Laura's nightstand.
Hi, as Scott said, this is On My Nightstand, and I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, reading to you something that I love, as usual. This time it is from the novel When She Comes Back by Ronit Plank. Ronit is a future guest on the show, so you're going to hear her whole story very soon. But I'll tell you a little bit about her. She is a writer, teacher, and podcaster with work in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Rumpist, The Iowa Review, The American Literary Review, among others. She is a host and producer of the award-winning podcast, And Then Everything Changed, featuring interviews with survivors, authors, thought leaders, and people in recovery about pivotal moments in their lives and decisions that have defined them. Sounds like a podcast I need to be on, actually. I fell in love with this book. It's so good. And it's a memoir. So just to set up where we are in the book, Ronit's character is about fifth grade, I think, where we are in the book. She lives with her father and sees her mother on weekends, but she's talking in this chapter about the weekends that she's actually with her father and not with her mother. And I'm just going to read to you from one of my favorite chapters, which is called Lady of the House. When we were in Seattle and my parents were newly separated, my father took me out on what he called quote-unquote dates, canoeing, and to movies. Now, on the night of my first date in 7 years with him alone, I kissed Nava goodnight and waved goodbye to the babysitter, as if I was a mother leaving the apartment with my partner, headed out for a night of fun. My arm looped in my father's, I gallivanted down Casino Boulevard like I had won a prize. I felt protected and, most importantly for me, chosen. We went to dinner and I told him about my day at school and who was fighting with whom and what girl had done what. I reveled in our father-daughter time and came home that night rejuvenated. On a date several months after that, I decided to wear my father's ivory Irish sweater and fisherman's cap and his coat, an army surplus bomber jacket in military green. They were all big on me, but I didn't care. They were proof of our connection. We headed down Casino again, and I took his arm. "Ah, I like that," he said. It was cold and dark out. The shops were still open, but closing soon. We went to Lychee Village, the way we always did, but ate more quickly, since we had a movie to catch. Even though it was rated R, I had convinced my father that he should take me to see Christine, the latest movie adapted from a novel by Stephen King. The theater was an old one, with ornate carvings and moldings in the lobby, from a time when Flushing was part of the promise of New York City. It must have been beautiful when it was built, but it was run down now. A paint-chipped balcony looked over the worn red velvet seats. Heavy beige curtains hung in front of the screen, and when the lights dimmed, they dragged open in slow motion, like somebody had grown tired while pulling the cord. My father and I bought popcorn and Coke and found seats. I chatted and watched the other people file in. The theater was filled with the sounds of couples settling into their seats, their muffled laughs and whispers, the scent of perfume and minty gum. In the dim theater with my father surrounded by adults on dates, part of me grew alert, uneasy. Maybe it wasn't clear anymore that I was his daughter. Maybe those around me would mistake me for my father's young girlfriend. I hoped I still looked enough like a kid that I wouldn't give anyone the wrong impression. For good measure, I called him Dad several times as I talked to him, spackling the awkwardness with words, as I tended to do when I was self-conscious. My father leaned toward me and listened while I stammered and then grew quiet. I was thankful when the movie started and I could look at the screen without thinking. The suspense and gore made the film scarier than I had anticipated, but that didn't bother me as much as the lust between the men and women on screen. Every time the characters started fooling around, I braced myself. The two leads made out, and I pulled to the left of my father so our shoulders couldn't touch. I wanted to get out of there. Though I had picked the movie, I wished we hadn't come. But I didn't want to admit what was wrong. He was the parent I was most connected to. And if I told him how I was feeling, our bond would become tenuous, our relationship awkward. Besides, what kind of girl became uncomfortable around her father unless something was wrong with her? I had no courage to acknowledge my uneasiness and no language to express it. Instead of saying, "This movie is a gross one to watch with you, Dad. Let's go home," I hunkered down and fortified myself. My father, for his part, didn't say or do anything to indicate he was troubled or that we should leave, so we stayed. My new discomfort with our closeness surprised me, because in other ways I'd grown bolder. I'd been snooping in his bedroom for the last year. Nava and I were often on the hunt, but I was more driven. Sometimes after school I brought friends over, mostly my best friend Claudia, and the same friends who helped me crank call sex lines to mess with the women on the other end, and I took them into his room with me. My father had a pretty hefty collection of Playboy magazines. Strangely, Grandpa Sammy had passed them along to him before leaving for Florida. My father also had a collection of magazines called We. Still a year away from taking French class in middle school, I could not imagine what We meant or how to say it. In my head, I pronounced it owie, which I thought might refer to the discomfort the ladies in the magazine appeared to experience with sex, their eyes shut and heads thrown back and wincing glossy mouths, or their eyebrows arched high in surprise over vacant-looking eyes and open, pouting lips. I picked out a magazine from the stack on his bedroom floor. Crouching in the tile, I studied each photo, only turning the page when I'd taken in everything I could about the model. Her eye color, lipstick, jewelry, and hair. I scrutinized her body, wondering if I would grow up to look like that too. If I would ever do things that she was doing in that photo. Once, I stole enough quarters from the laundry money mug in my father's room to purchase a copy of Playgirl. Claudia was with me when I bought it at the mom-and-pop corner store we didn't usually go to. I tossed the magazine on the counter as casually as I could, and the cashier stared at me for a long moment. I wasn't sure she'd sell it to me, but then she accepted the quarters I counted out, and I snuck the magazine home in my bag. We looked at it for a little while, but the photos of naked men didn't enthrall me the way I'd hoped. I threw the Playgirl out and went back to snooping in my father's drawers. It didn't occur to me that it was reasonable for a parent not to reveal everything to their kids. For me, anything he kept private signaled an unsettling difference between us, an omission or a breach of trust. If Nava and I were indeed my father's primary focus, if we three were a family and I was his partner, there was no reason for him to keep himself apart from us. I didn't understand why there had to be a dividing line between our family of three and his private romantic life, why he needed a space for himself, especially because he was so open with us in other ways. When he and Nava and I ran errands in the neighborhood on weekends, I saw him notice the women we walked by. Whenever Nava and I watched TV with him and a pretty woman came on, he snapped to attention. "Hello there," he'd say, or "Who do we have here?" as if the woman had appeared on screen just for him. I took note and assessed her too, searching for what made her so special and how I might be captivating in that way. On an afternoon when Nava was at a friend's house and my father was at work, I went into his room again. Since he quit cigarettes and started smoking a pipe, the cooped-up air in there smelled more like fresh-cut tobacco and apples than ash. He'd slice up a Red Delicious or a Macintosh and let Nava and me sprinkle small, pale chunks of the fruit in his Captain Black because he heard it kept the tobacco moist. I scanned his bathroom and rifled through his desk drawer. I moved to his bedroom closet and opened the accordion doors. I studied his shoes, checked his shelves. I flipped through his dress shirts, smelling each one for perfume, hoping I could unearth the hidden partners in my dad's life, looking for a sign of the women I was certain he'd had over but didn't know about. Toward the end of his rack of starched shirts, I found what I was looking for, evidence that he had a secret, someone who belonged only to him, separate from me. The shirt was collarless and sheer. It looked like a woman's nightshirt. I took the nightshirt off the hanger, stripped to my underwear, and slipped the shirt on. I stood on his bed so I could check myself out in the mirror that hung on the opposite wall. I flipped my hair and stuck my hips out to one side, with the confidence I'd seen in women who acted sexy. I struck the poses on my father's old matchbook covers. I worked my face into expressions like those I'd seen in his magazines, the pained looks of ecstasy, the fake shyness. I flipped my hair again and pouted. I wanted to see if I measured up to his girlfriends. I knew I could be grown up in this way, too. Then, almost like a gear shifted inside me that it ratcheted too far, nausea washed over me. My mouth went dry. I knew with every part of me that what I was doing was wrong, that I did not want this. I flung the shirt off of me, fumbled it onto a hanger, and slammed his closet door shut. Clutching my clothes, I hurried out of his room, away from his private life and the things that went on in there that I wasn't supposed to be a part of. From there on out, I kept myself away from him, emotionally and physically. I never drank from his water glass, never borrowed his jacket or his hat again, for fear it would magically bind us. Any way I could keep us apart, I did. As I left childhood, I invented more rituals that I believe prevented our closeness. I didn't taste anything from his plate or fork, and when I did laundry for the household after school on Friday, I washed my father's and Nava's clothes together and mine and Nava's together, but I would not mix mine with his. And when we walked in the neighborhood, I stayed far ahead of him and Nava, or lagged behind, hoping that I could break off from their family of two and protect myself from playing the pseudo-mom or the pseudo-partner role I'd grown so uncomfortable with. My father would ask Nava why I was so angry with him, and she tried to explain, but she didn't understand it. I didn't fully understand it either. I see now that because my father was unaware or unable to see the natural separation adolescents go through with their parents, I was driven to create a rift between us, a kind of moat that he wouldn't dare cross. If he wasn't going to give me the space I needed, I would have to distance myself. I no longer wanted the power in the house. I didn't want to be grown up or pretty around him. I wore baggy clothes, stopped casually chatting with him, and removed any enthusiastic inflection from my voice when we did speak. The closeness I had with him, the way he treated me like a grown-up when I was too young to really understand what that meant, had now become something dangerous, like the boys in the pool knowing where I lived. I began to use Nava as a buffer, since she had been and still was a bona fide child in the family. Certainly she was far more innocent than I was, incapable of making incorrect, inappropriate decisions as I had, like going on dates with my father and wearing his clothes. It was, I felt, my fault that my father and I had been too close. It never occurred to me that he might need to also consider our boundaries, that maybe he could have provided a different structure to our home life so I could stop taking on the role of his partner, our mainly missing mother. On My Nightstand is a special segment of the Only One in the Room podcast. Today's episode was produced by Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, and executively produced by Christina Barcy, who we call Barcy. Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible, brand new Only One interview, and every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading from something that I love. If you have an Only One in the Room story or a piece of writing that you'd like to share, please submit it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.